Paper 5, Section 2. This is old single column, page 64. And if you can remember back, 3 weeks back in the midst of time, the way this paper started out, remember how that we read that first section and we thought, wow, it's quite a bit, but it's actually meant to be quite accessible, quite approachable. We recognized, and that was the title of the section, The Approach to God. So that's the way they started this fifth of the five papers on God the Father out, in a very engaging, approachable fashion. And it's going to stay pretty straightforward as we go forward here. But you'll notice this first little paragraph that we'll want to pause and contemplate a little bit is invoking a lot of obvious complexity about deity that we're kind of used to recognizing now. So it'll be interesting to just spend a little time recognizing that's the way they chose this to start this off, and why. So who'd like to read here? Let's just jump in. Okay.
The presence of God. The physical presence of the infinite is the reality of the material universe. The mind presence of deity must be determined by the depth of individual intellectual experience and by the evolutionary personality level. The spiritual presence of divinity must of necessity be differential in the universe. It is determined by the spiritual capacity of receptivity and by the degree of the consecration of the creature's will to the doing of the divine will.
Okay. So before we notice any of the more profound details, just look at what's being said between the lines there. It's pretty sharp little poke at us. This comment about the depth of individual intellectual experience, evolutionary personality level. Okay, so in other words, your degree of experience, so the mind presence of deity, is going to be pretty limited if you're shallow and a low life. Just put it in a little bit more colloquial language there, flipping those two statements around. If you don't have a great depth, what do we call that? You're shallow. And if you're functioning at a really low level, that would be called a low life. They often are doing that. They won't be crude like that, but you can pause and ask yourself it in a little more pointed fashion. How does the universe look at me? Do they consider me to be plumbable by a very, very short ruler, and kind of right down there with the catfish, or how am I viewed in the eyes of the universe? Okay, but that aside, it should have kind of struck you. I mean, it's kind of a interesting way to launch this off. I mean, to start off by using the term the infinite, and okay, let's notice the pairs of things first. In that one I was just pointing out, you have two things separated by an and. Okay, so the mind presence of deity must be determined by the depth of individual intellectual experience, a relationship with experiential deity. And by the evolutionary personality level. You know, where does personality come from? It comes from the Father, existential deity. You know, your personality level, you know, at what level do you exist? I mean, you've gotten there by an evolutionary process, yes, but you exist at some level. See, so you have experiential on the one hand, existential on the other hand. You know, it depends upon both of those. See, it must be determined by both of those, your relationship to experiential deity and your relationship with existential deity. And then there's another pair. And they bring up the spiritual presence. You know, again, it is determined by the spiritual capacity of receptivity. Does that remind you of something? You know, what are we always talking about when we bring up capacity? Is that the Father? No, that's the Mother. Right? That's the Mother. Mother is the source of capacity. And you know, the degree of consecration to the of the creature's will to doing of the divine will. Oh, that last, that's the twofold consecration. You know, how much have you consecrated your mind to the universal harmony, God the Mother, i.e., how much capacity of receptivity do you have? And then also, what degree have you consecrated your will to the perfect will of God the Father? And you can have loads and loads of consecration of your will to the will of the Father, but if you have just an embryonic capacity, it's not going to go anywhere. You have to have both. Well, we've talked about that over and over and over. Okay, see, so both of them, you know, experiential, existential, that's the Mother, that's the Father. You see, so this is a classic example of noticing you've got two things separated by and if you just reflect on them for a minute, you can see one is God the Mother and one is God the Father. And, you know, and then notice, you know, what else you have going on here. You've got, you know, you have that curious thing of starting out with invoking the infinite. You know, and you go, well, you know, why choose to say it that way? I mean, why bring in something, you know, that by and large you don't really talk about much unless it's in that passing up and the forward or you're getting into deity and reality. You know, why bring in a more complex term like that? Well, like we've pointed out, so think about, you know, that's the first thing that's said. And then following that is two different ways of expressing that parallel between God the Mother and God the Father. You know, we've talked about how if you think about an initial state where all there is a conceptual God the Infinite, and then God the Infinite separates into God as transcendence, and then the God that remains within, God as immanence. Well, there it is. You start with God the Infinite, you know, and it's expressed, at, you know, subsequently you have this twofold expression, God the Mother, God the Father. In order to be thinking that, I need to be in a very definitive top-down mode to sort of be, just in the right frame of mind to recognize that that's the way the paragraph is constructed. So what did they do? We've talked about, you know, noticing whether they capitalized the words deity and divinity, you know, and why they do it. And you may recall, it's not that long ago that we talked about that with a little bit of specificity. You know, back when we were in paper 118, specifically 118 section 4, and even more specifically, just like here, the first paragraph of that section and the first paragraph of this section use the capital D divinity. As a matter of fact, these two are purposely linked. This is the very first time in the book when they use the capital D divinity, and that one that we read not so long ago, that's the last time in the book that they use the capital D divinity. Those bookends of using that expression are very purposely linked here. And now remember what the whole point is about whether or not you capitalize the D in deity, say. I mean, it's about whether or not we're thinking about coming top down or bottom up. You know, do we have deity potentials, lowercase d, that we're going to actualize? Is it the bottom up flow, you know, the upward flow, or is it the downward flow we're talking about, where it's capital D deity? You know, and so they change whether that's capitalized or not. In the same way with divinity, if you're talking, you know, divinity fundamentally is deity likeness. That's the quality of deity, deity likeness. Well, are we talking about top down deity likeness or bottom up deity likeness? The divinity that we'll eventually express is lowercase d divinity. It's bottom up. You know, this is top down deity likeness, capital D divinity. So, I mean, by purposely capitalizing the D on divinity, there's no denying the fact that they're trying to get you to think in a top down flow. You know, and just what I said, you know, imagine you begin with God the Infinite and then you actualize that as that fundamental twofold expression of that which overarches existential deity, God the Father, and which overarches or arches experiential deity, God the Mother. And if you look back, that when we did 118 section 4, that was a pretty heavy duty section. And if anything, I pointed out as we went through that's a very key section in talking about some of the more sophisticated, advanced aspects of total deity. That was a very important section for that. In particular, that's where they really speak to that fact that the capacity producing phenomenon is not the Father, it's the Mother. You know, that was one of the big things in that section, was that notion of capacity, talking about that, where it comes from, how it's expressed. What do you see in this paragraph? Capacity. Okay? This is you know, how carefully this thing is constructed. Okay? Those two sections, you know, this one and 118 section 4, are very purposely initiated in almost identical fashion to get you to link them together when you're ready to be in a more advanced mode of recognition as you read the rest of this section. They want the advanced reader to be going, you know, when we talk about the presence of God, there's two types of presence. I mean, I'm here within. Okay? I experience two types of presence. I experience a very intimate presence. God is immanence. And I experience the presence of transcendence. You know, there's a ubiquity and there's an omnipresence. Okay, so, you know, but if you're not, you know, if you're not up to sorting out those more advanced details, you know, you can just begin to, you know, try to advance your idea of God the Father forward here. But, you know, this paragraph that in a, you know, for a new reader is going to go, well, I don't know what the heck they were talking about there. Let's just keep reading. See, what it's doing is it's trying to get you in the full mode of saying, think about both Mother and Father. You know, and the twofold presence, you know, and the differential of that presence, and the relationship, you know, of everything to, you know, this bidirectional flow, a top down and a bottom up flow. It's all right there. Okay, so now that we've noticed that they want us to be actively thinking about both Father and Mother, let's read the next paragraph.
God lives in every one of his spirit-born sons. The paradise sons always have access to the presence of God. the right hand of the Father. And all of his creature personalities have access to the bosom of the Father. This refers to the personality circuit. Whenever, wherever, and however contacted or otherwise entails personal, self-conscious contact and communion with the Universal Father, whether at the central abode or at some other designated place, as on one of the seven sacred spheres of paradise.
Okay, just, you know, let's pick out the obvious thing first. Okay, so that biblical expression, bosom of the Father. Bosom of the Father, otherwise known as the Mother. Okay? Last time I checked, that's what that's pointing to. Yeah, nothing fuzzy about the word bosom. Okay? See? Note they've picked out two, you know, classic biblical, you know, phrases. Okay? The right hand of the Father. Okay, so you have this existential deity. You know, and you have a paradise son is this direct hand, you know, expression of existential deity. You know, so that's, you know, on the one hand, you have that kind of presence relationship, that like, for instance, a creator son, you know, one of the paradise sons, you know, the relationship that a creator son has to the Father. You know, literally, some of the Father type deity is within a creator son. So their linkage is very direct. You know, that direct existential foundational linkage. That creator son feels the presence of the Father very directly as this God of transcendence presence. But a creature, like there's, you know, like ourselves, okay, it's different. There it says, and all his creature personalities have access to the Mother. You know, this distinction is vital. I mean, the only way that we can, be somehow connected to God is transcendence, and that God is transcendence can be connected to us. I mean, he pulled himself outside of infinity. You know, he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. How is there any linkage through the Mother? We're linked. For that personality circuit to somehow be able to connect in, it's only via the Mother that personality circuit can connect in. I mean, you're directly associated with the Father. It's not like she's, blocking the linkage, but she makes the linkage possible. I mean, just in the same way the Spirit of Truth is directly engaging you, but only because the Mother is providing the substrate upon which that Spirit of Truth can get between Michael and you. Michael can't magically bridge the gap. The Father can't magically bridge the gap with his personality circuit either. It's only because you have access to the Mother, like they're saying here, that you as a creature also feel the presence of the Father. And then on top of that, of course, there's the presence of God the Mother. So there's a twofold presence. But, you know, the main focus here is the Father, obviously. We brought that up. You know, this distinction is vital, for in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. That includes the Universal Father. He's not exempt from that. He's one of the, members of that cosmic system. It's only through the whole and through the individuality of the whole that he reaches us and we reach him. And that's what there's telling you here, by very cleverly picking a biblical expression that if you're thinking, there is that darn expression, the bosom of the Father. What the heck is the bosom of the Father? I mean, isn't that a female word?
Where's the Father part?
I mean, again, you know, this, the Father, I mean, what good, you know, what's the point of being God the Father if there's no place to engage? There has to be that which he's going to engage, which is upheld. You know, I mean, a way you could drop back to the first paragraph and think about, if you wanted to think about it and express it really technically, specifically, you have, you know, you have both the initiator from the infinite and the bosom from the infinite. Okay? I mean, that's technically, well, at least if we start with the concept of God the infinite, we split it into that which is within, the bosom of the infinite, and then that which is without is the initiator, okay, of all the individualities that are going to be within. So, you know, but the, you know, the passage in the Bible is the bosom of the Father, you know, so they're just, you know, taking that. It's like, now just think about that a little bit. Yeah.
Chris, where is it numerous in the Bible? You're quoting that from bosom of the
Father? No, bosom of the Father, that's right. You know where that is. That's right at the end of the beginning of John, the book of John. Yeah,
okay, that's what Apostle I was wondering. John. It's just in the New Testament. It's just something Jesus talked about.
Yeah, that's
it's
that.
Not, it's not the prophet.
That's right at, you know, it's like, you know, right at the very end of that, you know, the little intro at the beginning of the Gospel of John, you know, like, I don't know, about the 18th verse or so, is that bosom of the Father. Yeah. I mean, the right hand of the Father, you know, that's all over the place. Yeah, that's in lots of places. All right, so you know, and then now let's, you know, just notice the little detail. So they're, you know, they're reminding you, for if you're ready to recognize that, of technically how this works. You got to have the mother in order to make all this linkage possible. But there's going to be two types of linkage. There's the remote linkage. You know, we have a remote experience of the presence of the Father out here, whenever, wherever, and however, you know, the mother is helping to bridge this gap between paradise and here. Then, of course, we actually could be standing on paradise, you know, whether at the central abode. I mean, there's also, you know, being linked. But even then, even if I'm standing right there and, you know, on the aisle, you know, or on one of the Father's worlds, I still need the mother nature to link us together. See? You know, and remember how one of the things we recognized, what have I acquired when I reach the Isle of Paradise so that I can go out and be God revealing, you know, as a finaliter? I've acquired God the Mother likeness. So I have all this real definitive God the Mother likeness when I'm finally standing on Paradise. And I need all of it to be able to bridge this this now incredible possibility of linkage. I mean, again, there's no magic. I mean, you're going, well, I'm standing right in the presence, so boy, I'm going to really be able to feel the presence. Well, only if you have the capacity to feel the presence.
Yes,
yeah. What do they tell you? If they sent you there now, you have zero capacity right now. You wouldn't experience anything. You don't have any God the Mother likeness to be, you know, you have no capacity there that's going to experience the Father's presence, even though he's standing right in front of you, quote unquote. Yeah. So that's they're just trying to get you to finally put all the pieces together logically. Yeah, and that's what those two paragraphs offer for the more advanced student, is to see the whole picture of God the Father and God the Mother in another setting, you know, and even to bring the Bible alive, you know, and not have it, you know, not have it be such an odd expression that newer, you know, more recent translations of the Bible don't use that expression, bosom of the Father, anymore. They've altered the expression. It's like, well, that's just too confusing. That sounds like female, and God is a male, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, and so it's not expressed that way anymore. Okay? Yeah. But they're saying, no, that's exactly what it's supposed to say.
Even though this is direct telling us to think top down, as you were speaking there, especially with capacity, mm-hmm. it started to help clarify the seven psychic circles. This sounds like maybe some clues to help move that a little bit forward.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, You know, and then you can go back and go, oh, yeah, they did say. Now, to be a little bit more technically precise about it, instead of thinking of them as psychic circles, which we're calling them so that you kind of have the analogy to the circles of Avona, I mean, technically, they're cosmic levels. They're levels of growing relationship with God the Mother, growing capacity, you know, not only for God the Mother likeness, but God the Father connectivity. Right. I mean, the more capacity you have, the more you can engage a thought adjuster. If you have no capacity, you can't. It doesn't matter if that thought adjuster is literally within your mind. There's not going to be any connection. That's why this twofold consecration is so important to recognize. You can have just loads and loads of consecrating of your will to, you know, like to connect with that adjuster within, but if your capacity is the size of a thimble, you know, and most of that will, it has nowhere to go. I mean, all you need is a thimble full of will, because all you have is a thimble full of capacity.
With age and years and growing wisdom, does your capacity grow?
Well, you are grown. We're going to read about that a little bit, you know, about that whole growth thing. There's a degree to which we progress in spite of ourselves, but obviously there's going to be a limit, you know. I mean, you know, there's several places, you know, if you think about it, there's lots and lots of places in the book where they remind you, it's like, well, you know, there's an initial, you know, grace mode where some things kind of happen because you need to get going. But if you're going to get anywhere significant, you know, this has to be an active choice phenomenon. I mean, if the Spirit of Truth is going to be able to, you know, to work within you and bring more of the adjuster into relationship with what you're up to, I mean, that requires capacity. You have to make the temple bigger. You know, the size of the temple is a measure of the degree of relationship to God the Mother. Bigger the temple, greater the relationship with God the Mother. Bigger the temple, the more the adjuster can be somewhere besides imprisoned. The only way that you're going to have a living relationship with the adjuster is if the adjuster is not in a straitjacket. So you have to make the temple big enough so that the adjuster has, you know, space to move its arms, or there's not going to be any living relationship. You're just going to experience something that's imprisoned inside of you, because that's all the capacity you've given it, just enough for it to be in a straitjacket.
To me, that involves increasing our integrative ability of the revelation. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, the consecration of the mind is going to involve a growing, you know, progressing philosophy of living. And it's not just going to be existential. It's not just going to be the existence part. You know, you've got to choose. You know, now, I mean, man cannot cause growth. So, but, you know, you have to choose to supply the favorable conditions to be grown. And we're going to, you know, get to that a little bit as we get forward here.
Well, it seems to me that this is going to be achieved mostly through stillness, to actually be communing and talking with your adjuster.
You'll see that they're kind of going to try to point out that that is only an initiating thing. That doesn't get you very far. You'll see that they directly address that as we read forward here a little bit. Think about, let's just take 1 second here to talk about it. I mean, remember some of the key words associated with the temple, you know, contemplation, you know, with the temple. You know, there's contemplative prayer, there's contemplative worship, you know, it's going to be coming up. We're talking about true worship in the next section. And then there's meditation. That's being present with that stillness. That's just the initiation step. I mean, to get to the point where you can be in the meditative state, where you actually can find the temple within and hold a presence there, and not just immediately be pulled down back down to the bottom part of the hourglass by material gravity and get caught up in all the falderal again. You know, can you, you know, step apart within and hold that for more than 5 seconds? You know, you need to practice being there first. But one must do something as well as be something. The point is not being. Being doesn't get you to paradise. Doing gets you to paradise. So you have once you're able to hold a presence there, now work on doing what you're supposed to do in there. You're supposed to be reflecting in there. You're supposed to be linking the self and the cosmos through the temple.
Mine was in contrast to listening to the TV all the time or the radio or chitter-chatter constantly. You know, that was what I was contrasting.
Right. But then once you can do at that higher level, the TV can be on and everything, and you're still in a reflective state because now you're not just a subjective phenomenon that, you know, has to be whatever the TV tells you. I mean, the self down in the bottom part of the hourglass is subject to the TV. The personal self that can dwell in the upper part of the hourglass, in the temple, in the heart, is not subject to the TV or the neighbor's kids or whatever. It's objective. It can have the TV on, and it can actually draw something of value out of it.
That's right, yeah. You start seeing where...
Because you're the master.
How do you know you're just doing the TV?
Yeah, there's the question. How can you get to the state where you can hear, you know, you can hear a still small voice while the TV's on? I mean, just put that challenge in front of you.
But you're not putting down the value of seeking to go, making an attempt to go to a still place inside yourself. If we don't make an attempt to go there and hold that up as a good place to start, I think that we're missing.
And it also may be the only thing that you can do. The issues may be too severe. I mean, think about even for Michael incarnate. He occasionally just needed to go apart. Okay, because what he was dealing with was so difficult for someone who perforce must serve two masters that there's no way, you know, no way even he could really do both at the same time. All he could do is just go apart, recharge a little bit, and then go back down into the trenches. But all I'm saying is don't assume that everything is like that. The lesser things, you can develop the ability to not have to go apart from them in order to find some object. You can bring objectivity down from the mountaintop into that little issue. By the time you're a million years old and way up in your ascension scheme, you'll be able to bring, you know, objectivity into some really big circumstances. But now, I mean, you know, and maybe in this life, you know, all you can master is just being able to hold a presence in the temple for any length of time. You know, and if you accomplish that as a start, that's a great start. But just always, you know, always be thinking about why you're doing that. You're not doing, you know, whatever you're doing at any, you know, how do they, you know, any evolutionary personality level, no matter what level you're at, the reason you're doing what's at that level is so that you have a foundation to do what's at the next level up. None of the levels are an end in themselves. And that's why I bring up, I mean, meditation is not an end in itself. The kind of reflection that you can do with an agitant mind is not an end in itself. You're going to try to begin to leave that behind when you have in the next life and begin to bring in, you know, the kind of reflection that you only have with Marantxa consciousness, you know, et cetera, all the way up. Let's see. Maybe here, let's do this one first. Since you haven't, you know.
You get this. You're going along in your daily life and you're bombarded with a whole bunch of stuff, but there's inside you just stay strong and have that inner strength from God and carry it with you always.
At least be trying your best to stay centered like that, you know, as you walk, knowing that, you know, you may have to go apart a little bit. You know, don't, you know, immediately assume I can handle, you know, because, you know, there's a, sometimes you may have to go apart, and that's fine. Don't, you know, don't look down on that. There's nothing negative about that. I mean, like I said, I mean, you know, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. That's one of the things he demonstrated for us. Sometimes problems are really big. You've, you know, let yourself unplug and go apart. That's fine. You're not, you know, admitting defeat or something. You know, I mean, it's a positive thing. Sometimes you need to go apart. But always be working to try to stay in the game for the lesser things. It's like, you know, I've mastered that circumstance. I don't have to go apart in the face of that. You know, there's some self-mastery. Myself is no longer subject to that kind of a vicissitude. It may be still subject to a bigger, you know, a sledgehammer, but it's not subject to that little thing anymore. I'm the master now of that circumstance, not the situation. Oh, there was one more thing. Yeah.
All the events of this sequential life that we have, the thought adjuster is spiritizing all of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually they'll all come together as realization. You don't have to get it right now. He's doing his job.
Yeah, and you'll see that's where they end this section. That's the final paragraph of this section, is to address basically your point. So, you know, just... Right, and that's what, just see where they're going. You know, see, they know what you were thinking. Just, you know, so see where they take it. Okay, but it's going to, you know, it's a little bit of a transition now. It's just this first part had this kind of bigger, heavy duty stuff. It's like, okay, now let's just talk about kind of the basic facts now.
The divine presence cannot, however, be discovered anywhere in nature or even in the lives of God-knowing mortals so fully and so certainly as in your attempted communion with the indwelling mystery monitor, the paradise thought adjuster. What a mistake to dream of God far off in the skies when the spirit of the universal Father lives within your own mind.
Just notice how cleverly they transitioned. That first statement is, you know, you've got mother, you know, they've injected, you're thinking about God the mother, and his evolutionarily, you know, that makes us think of the expression mother nature. So the very first thing they address is the divine presence cannot, however, be discovered anywhere in nature so fully and so certainly as, so, and saying, you know, that's going to make you, thinking about the mother is going to make you think about nature. It's like, well, yeah, but, I mean, you don't need to try to somehow find God in nature. You've got a thought adjuster, you know, try that first. you know, and if you, the extent to which you find, you know, begin to develop more of a synchronization with the adjuster, nature is going to take on all the greater beauty. The presence of the mother in the whole will become all the more clearer. Let the adjuster, you know, improve your vision. Yeah. So, you know, you just notice that, you know, you can say, well, why did they bring in nature there? That's why. It's because mother should have been in your mind from the first two paragraphs.
It is because of this God fragment that indwells you that you can hope, as you progress in harmonizing with the adjuster's spiritual leadings, more fully to discern the presence and transforming power of those other spiritual influences that surround you and impinge upon you, but do not function as an integral part of you. The fact that you are not intellectually conscious of close and intimate contact with the indwelling adjuster does not in the least disprove such an exalted experience. The proof of fraternity with the divine adjuster consists wholly in the nature and extent of the fruits of the Spirit which are yielded in the life experience of the individual believer. By their fruits you shall know them.
So just notice their choice of words, how they started that out. Harmonizing with the adjuster's spiritual leadings. Again, think about the more complex understanding of what's going on in your relationship with the adjuster. Again, it's through mother-likeness that you have a relationship to that father-like existential core of the adjuster. You are harmonizing with the universal harmony, harmonizing with the cosmos, harmonizing with that experiential nature that's, you know, that is what you engage of the adjuster. You're not engaging that existential core. The adjuster has built up an experiential nature. It's a point of harmony now within your mind. It's not just a fragment of the Father in your mind like it is when it's a virgin adjuster. Once it's an experienced adjuster, it's a point of harmony, clear, pure, perfect harmony wrapped around the Father fragment core. You know, it's an extremely valuable reference point in your mind. I want to try to harmonize everything in my life and my relationship to the cosmos. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I had a pure example of what harmony looks like? A clear view of an existential fragment is not going to help me here. I need someone to model harmony for me. Okay? The adjuster's experiential nature is a point of harmony in your mind that you can harmonize with, just like they're saying here. And the more you harmonize with that example, that model of harmony, like they say, everything else begins to be more, everything else can begin to engage you more. You know, there's a greater relationship. All the, you know, the those other spiritual influences that surround you and impinge upon you, you know, all those things, there can be going to be greater relationship with all of that. And it's because of this connection with the harmony point in your mind.
Yeah. Okay.
The Persian adjuster is coming right from God. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has no experience. It's just pure God.
Right.
And so he doesn't have to go into the land of we are, because he can't experience to handle our world.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
But he would go to places that maybe they wouldn't have such struggle.
Right. I mean, virgin adjusters, for instance, go to primitive mortals, where the mortal isn't a primitive mortal is not needing a point of harmony in their mind yet. They're not that complex of a phenomenon yet. They don't. They're trying to get up to the point where you need a point of harmony, so they don't need an experienced adjuster, and so they're not given one. But those of us who are beginning to be in need of an example of what harmony looks like, we're given a point of harmony. And coincidentally, no matter how much you might independently choose to really start making progress, all of a sudden you won't catch God off guard. It won't go, whoa, if we had any idea Pam was going to make this much progress, we would have sent her a supreme adjuster instead of an advanced adjuster.
They already know.
Coincidentally, you won't outrun your adjuster's experiential nature. Okay, that's the beauty of how the whole system works. It's never the case that some mortal is going to be found wanting in the adjuster's ability. It's like, man, that person shouldn't have gotten a virgin adjuster. They needed it. That's never going to happen.
They didn't give Jesus a virgin.
Yeah, they gave Jesus one of the most experienced adjusters, possible.
Right. One Melchizedek
had. Right, and probably many other things, Okay. Right, because he needed as much of that point of what harmony looks like as could be given to him. Yeah. I probably need almost none. Okay, I don't probably don't have a virgin adjuster like he does. We basically don't have any virgin adjusters, but they probably have a minor league advanced adjuster is probably what I've got. But okay,
comes to mind when they talk about the influences. Spiritual influences that surround you is our guardian angels. They might also be talking about the midwares. Who else would be on that list other than a thought adjuster?
The spiritual. The first thing is just the Holy Spirit, Spirit of Truth. There's all these. There's this spirit mind presence of the infinite Spirit. There's the spirit presence of the eternal Son. There's even the presence of the Supreme Spirit. You remember the sevenfold spirit presence that they talk about way up there, towards the end of the Jesus papers. So the first thing is just going to be those non-personal spirit presences that it's going to be helping you harmonize with. And then, then you start bringing in the next, the first being one is definitely the seraphim. And then who knows what else. We all know that when you bring up the fruits of the Spirit, we're talking the cosmic fruits of the Spirit. And see, so now it all is very appropriate, why it's being said like this. You're definitively bringing to mind all of this issue about the cosmos, harmony, your relationship to God the Mother. And it's that relationship, that greater relationship to God the Mother, that allows you to manifest more than just those mere spiritual single word fruits of the Spirit, that your connection to the Father, that initiating connection, allows you to express. You can begin to express these full cosmic ones. And so, and that reminded me just one other little thing before we leave it totally behind. A little bit of a non sequitur, but that spiritual cosmic relationship. Just wanted to remind you, since we were recently talking about equity and equality, back there in that first paragraph, when they're doing deity and divinity, you notice how they chose to use those, which one they used deity for and which one they used divinity for. Okay, the full, matter, the superadditive consequence of the relationship between matter and spirit is mind. So when you have the full threefold cosmic thing in play, they used deity, and divinity is deity likeness. Remember how we pointed out there's the same kind of a parallel between equity and equality. Equality is equity likeness. In particular, it's that spirit essence of the full cosmic picture. And see, that's just exactly what they did here too. See, they used divinity for this, the spiritual presence, for the full picture, they used deity. So there's deity, and then there's the projection of that deity into a spiritual plane, and that's divinity, that's deity likeness. But it's just more directly tied to the you can certainly use that difference to kind of in this context to get you thinking about that relationship between spirit and the whole threefold picture, that becomes harmonized by personality. So they never miss an opportunity, to try to get you to think about those, that relationship between cosmic and merely spiritual.
I hope their oversight to the people who are translating into other languages is sufficient to...
As you see how difficult this is to translate when you begin to see how much sophistication there is in this construct. So there we are. So we've got all of this. The cosmic fruits of the Spirit are going to be manifest. Even if you're completely clueless of any, notice how they were saying that. They're not intellectually conscious. There doesn't have to be any awareness of an adjuster presence at all. If there actually is some sort of synchrony developing, you'll begin to manifest things that are more cosmic fruits of the Spirit and not just purely spiritual joy, love, just those single word ones. Okay? Then they give you a little bit more about the adjuster here.
It is exceedingly difficult for the meagerly spiritualized material mind of mortal man to experience marked consciousness of the spirit activities of such divine entities as the paradise adjusters. As the soul of joint mind and adjuster creation becomes increasingly
existent.
Existent. I'm sorry, it's kind of blurred there. There also evolves a new phase of soul consciousness, which is capable of experiencing the presence and of recognizing the spirit leadings and other supermaterial activities of the mystery monitors.
Would you go ahead and read that other one too, and then we'll talk about them both together.
The entire experience of adjuster communion is one involving moral status, mental motivation, and spiritual experience. The self-realization of such an achievement is mainly, though not exclusively, limited to the realms of soul consciousness. But the proofs are forthcoming in abundant in the manifestation of the fruits of the Spirit in the lives of all such inner spirit contractors.
Okay. So those two together, they're reminding you of some of the detailed mechanics of this relationship between your adjutant mind, your adjutant material self, and the adjuster's presence. So like they're saying to begin there, I mean, we all have to very humbly acknowledge that we're meagerly spiritualized. We have a very material mind. So don't be surprised if there's no marked consciousness of any of this stuff going on. But then they say, but remember, and we talked about this back in the adjuster papers, the more you begin to not be just an animal origin self, you know, basically in our hourglass analogy here, you know, your consciousness is really just down there in the lower part of the hourglass. The more part of that self is personalized. That personal self, see, has a presence up there in the upper domains of the hourglass. Those levels that are created by the three cosmic intuitions. Give it capacity. Give it volume. That personal self, as it begins to mature, even though, I mean, that is not the soul, you know, that temple is not the soul, that's still just your mortal self, but it's specifically the real personal self as opposed to just the animal origin self. That personal self has a linkage via the adjuster to the soul, which is, I mean, maybe in this model, let's imagine the soul is above that temple. You know, and there's a connection via the adjuster. So you have this separate Morantia self, this soul, which is very intimately connected to the adjuster. It's separately minded. You know, there's a separate consciousness there. It's not a personal consciousness. There's no personal self there. It's another just mere self. It's a Morantia self. Its consciousness is in Morantia mind. You know, it's making decisions. But as that personal self grows, we talked about this, there can begin to develop a little bit more of a synchronization between these two selves. Your personal self and that Morantia self can begin to have a little bit of synchronization. And hence, you know, a little bit of commonality both directions. It's not just the soul is sort of a copy of this personal self, you know, the true essence of this personal self. There begins to be some feedback where you can begin to benefit a little bit from that. So in that, thinking about that, notice how as the soul of joint mind and adjuster creation becomes increasingly existent, so you have more of a soul, which means you have more and more of a personal self too, that it's a copy of. There also evolves a new phase of soul consciousness, which is capable of experiencing the presence and of recognizing the spirit leadings of the other supermaterial activities of the mystery monitors. So more and more that soul has a real consciousness, and you have a linkage of that, and so there begins to be this positive feedback that's set up, you know. And so, in sometimes, just for kind of simplicity, you can kind of call what little bit of a reflection of the soul that's in that personal self. You can kind of think of that as your soul. It's not technically your soul, but it's more and more that personal self can actually be a phenomenon that can have a personal awareness of something that goes beyond just something that's working on transcending its animal origins. It can begin to be aware of the other's two selves and begin to grow in that threefold relationship, the divine self, the Maharaja self, and this personal self. And so in that thing, bringing that literal picture in, see they say the self-realization of such an achievement is mainly, though not exclusively, limited to the realms of soul consciousness. In terms of literally realizing a self-expression of these higher things, that's the soul. That's, like you're saying, that's mainly this realization of this higher relationship as a higher self. That's your soul. But not exclusively, like I say. See, there begins to be a little bit more of a soul-like personal self. Because after all, you get all the way up to a first circler, and you basically have made that personal adjutant self that's in the temple just like that Maharaja self, and you can transfer the seat of the personality now. From here over to there, you can begin that process of transferring the seat of personality. So you have that final stage, but there's going to be this whole gradation in between, and that's what they're alluding to, sort of between the lines there, about the though not exclusively. There begins to be this more and more soul-like adjutant self in play, but it's it's limited. But the extent to which there is a more soul-like personal self, more and more of the proof of its existence is going to be forthcoming, with the fruits as the fruits of the Spirit. Because in order to really manifest those cosmic fruits of the Spirit, you need a soul-like self to express it. The soul itself can't express. Only you, as an adjutant self can express. So you're going to have to get, a lot of its likeness in within your personal self in order for you to will it as an expression.
Do you think that if when one first starts to become conscious of that it is perceived as other or as self?
It's going to depend a little bit on the individual. I mean, if you're taking a very gradually approach to this, you'll probably never have an experience that you would use the word other to describe. If you have an epiphany event in your life, there could be a transitional sort of stage there where you're struggling to try to describe what you're experiencing, and other seems to be the only word that fits. It doesn't really seem to be you. It seems to be other. We all know that can be dangerous. When people have that sort of an experience, they often start to get pretty confused. First of all, that they might think that, God is literally within them, the being, not just this fragment, this pre-personal fragment. They might get confused to think that there's some sort of a literal God within them, presence within them, in a personal sense. That often is not very sustainable as a thought, because it's kind of, if you think about it, it's kind of illogical. And so what they end up doing is flipping around, and they start to, I'm actually that God-like thing, and I'm imprisoned in this material body. Start to flip the whole picture around. It can be a pretty unstabling thing to have too strong of an other experience, because it's going to be recognized as a better other, and you're going to want to be the better other, not the lesser other. You know, so it tends to be an unstable experience. But, you know, they're basically pointing, I mean, if you're growing in a very steady fashion, it's just going to be this very gradual transition where you just have a more and more, your consciousness is the consciousness of that personal self instead of the real animal origin self. And then more and more that consciousness of that personal self is going to take on more of a soul-like consciousness until finally you're a first circler. And you know, that would be the way you probably ought to try to do it. It's the least dangerous path.
Yeah. Seems to be alluding to the three cosmic
intuition. Yeah. I was going to bring that up. Yeah. So just, you know, again, we've talked about this. You know what creates the volume of the temple is those three floors, fourth, fifth, and sixth levels of meaning. And the adjuster is only there. So, you know, the entire experience of adjuster communion is up there. The adjuster's not down there in the bottom part of the hourglass. You know, any adjuster communion is happening up there. You know, and it's kind of fun to, you know, I mean, the moral status, okay, that's obviously the moral level, the fifth level of meaning. Spiritual experience, that's obviously the spiritual level, the sixth level of meaning. To think about, you know, that fourth level, they often, you know, use different phrases about that fourth level, the logical level, to kind of give you different senses of how it's entering into the picture. In this, you know, just that mental motivation, you know, it's the first step of objective awareness. And the motivation that brings into your consciousness, you know, into your mental state, to pursue more of that, it's like, wow, is that clarifying? That's really motivating. I could really use more of that. I mean, it, you know, it gets you excited to have that objectivity, that logical acumen. You know, so that's that mental motivation.
Before you were talking about, you know, getting a, getting in touch with, you know, the cosmic perspective and how we fit in there and kind of holding on to that as, as touchstone for where we're going, and holding on to God's hand essentially.
Yeah.
And then turning around and looking at our material world and then trusting, you know, in hold his hand and be willing to turn around and then put what we, you know, what we're getting from that relationship, relationship. Into our material world, and you feel like you're more, you have a different perspective, it's a different feeling, it's more, it's in a more objective kind of place, that get inside yourself.
And you'll find that if you're experiencing that mode where the cosmic is coming down into the world in front of you, through you, and you're struggling to find a word to express that, it's very likely that the word that you'll settle upon is the word peace, because that, you know, that is true peace, is when the cosmos is coming down through you and engaging what's in front of you. See, and this is what I was talking about earlier. If that's really happening, see, if the objective is engaging the subjective, if people see that, you know, that you aren't off on a mountaintop, you're actually engaged and there's this presence about you, they'll call that peace that passes all understanding. See, Jesus was in two different modes. Sometimes he was apart. Sometimes he was actively bringing that, you know, that cosmic nature into play, expressing it. When he did that, they described what he was, the state he was in, as peace that passes all understanding. A state of peace that isn't engaging difficulty doesn't pass all understanding. I mean, anyone can be peaceful on the mountaintop, or at least, you know, you can You know, if you have any human nature, you can go off on the mountaintop and eventually find some peace. Okay? But can you bring that peace down into play? Okay? Then you're having, you know, a totally different phenomenon going on.
It's almost like when you were describing the universal absolute and that tension presence. And it is a peace. It's a peace, yeah. But it's a dynamic, active,
right,
peace.
Right. That's
it's a dynamic peace.
Right. That's the key.
It's not a static peace.
Right. And that, the more you have that dynamic character,
it's thrilling.
The more you have the adjective on the next section. See, to not just have a worshipful state, but a true worshipful state is going to have this fundamentally dynamic character. You know, it's going to express cosmic motion. Remember, you know, when you actually have consciousness that is can kind of very directly synchronize with that, we call that moda, you know, which literally is the word motion in Latin, you know, inherent motion. You have an internal motion that synchronizes with the inherent motion of the cosmos. Okay. It's dynamic. It's true. True is that which is true is living. Okay, so let's get into this a little bit. Who wants to read? We got someone who wants to read? You want to read? Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, okay. Well, she's getting over. Okay.
Since we're in the presence of God section here, there was a suggestion made to somebody that when we're describing the presence of God within us to a new reader, to say personal presence of God instead of saying like indwelling adjuster. But then there was a controversy that came up saying, well, the adjuster is impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really say that you have a personal presence of God.
You're not possessed.
By that other person.
You're not being puppeted. You know? That adjuster is wholly subservient to your will. You're the person.
Right, you know? But you could still, I mean, God, it says that God is has his presence in all things, his personal presence in all things.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, that's what we're trying to describe. You know, notice the, that's why, you know, in that very first paragraph, you know, you start out the presence of God. It's like, okay, so I bet you the first paragraph is going to have the word God in it. Nope. First paragraph didn't have the word God in it. It had infinite and deity and divinity. It didn't have a being standing there. Right there in the very first paragraph, they're trying to, you know, get you into a different space. You know, it's like, well, I'm not satisfied with an impersonal presence. Okay, so you're not satisfied. I mean, that, you know, for a human to not be satisfied with the impersonal presence of deity is to not understand what you're talking about. The fragment, the impersonal fragment, is so much more than you can possibly use. You don't need personal presence. You can't even begin to use the impersonal presence. And so, and just challenge yourself to think. Well, you know, if that doesn't sound right, if your first reaction is to reject that, well, you need to up your notion of what deity is. I mean, self-animating substance itself, just spirit substance as a substance, is more profound than anything you've ever experienced. You know, if you could actually see a glob of spirit substance in front of you, you would worship it. I mean, everyone in this room would worship that glob of spirit substance. It would be so godlike from our primitive notion of things. We would all be worshiping that glob of spirit substance. Okay, I mean, that's how profound just the substance is. I mean, let alone if it's a fragment of deity. You know? I mean, so the whole point is for humans to up their game here. Let things be more profound than they've ever been. Basically the reason why humans have always wanted the presence of a being in is their highest notion of a being is the thing they call God, and it's just a fancy anthropomorphism. I mean, just spirit substance, the actuality of spirit substance is insanely cool. I mean, it's a lot like what they tell you, you know, I want to be in the seventh stage of light and life. It's like, well, okay, you can't even imagine beyond a normal world and a bestowal age, okay? Far removed from the first stage of light and life. I mean, the world, a normal world and a bestowal stage is so far beyond your wildest imagination. You know, we don't even know what we're talking about when we're talking about light and life. We're utterly clueless. That's what I'm saying. I mean, most of the time when we're thinking about what God is, what we're actually, the best we're really thinking about is what spirit substance is. Spirit substance is as cool as our notion of God. Deity and God are so far beyond that, we can't even imagine it. You know, they're trying to get us to think a lot bigger.
So, we have our personality gift. And then we have our relationship, our personal, close relationship with God. And that's very personal to me.
And that the reason it can be so personal is because of the Spirit of Truth. You know, remember in the most literal way, the hand that you're taking hold of is Creator's hand. You know, that's about what they're going to tell us here in this section. I mean, now He shows you the way. Take His hand, He will show you the way. He's the hand of the Father. They just told us that in this second paragraph here, this section. That's the hand you're taking hold of that feels so personal. The Spirit of Truth is a personal spirit ministry. It's a very personal thing that you can, it feels like a hand that you're taking hold of. You know, it's the Father brought down to you so that it can have that personal character to it. That's the glory of Pentecost. We now all have that presence, that much more personalized presence within our minds, instead of just an impersonal fragment of the Father. Okay, a little bit more, and then we got to read her.
She said hope, and I, and then I also heard the word trust. I always connect trust with faith. I don't think there's any hope there. I think it's a faith trust with the hand.
Hope is kind of running parallel to that faith trust assurance. There's a growing hope that runs parallel to that. There's a faint flicker of hope that is parallel to a faint flicker of faith. You know, grow that faith into trust, you can see further, and you have a hope that's not just sort of a desperate hope, you know. You're right.
Enduring hope.
It grows into those cosmic roots of the Spirit, see. Yeah.
True worship. Though the paradise deities from the universe standpoint are as one, in their spiritual relations with such beings as inhabit your rancha, they are also three distinct and separate persons. There is a difference between the Godheads in the matter of personal appeals, communion, and other intimate relations. In the highest sense, we worship the universal Father and Him only. True, we can and do worship the Father as He is manifested in His Creator sons, but it is the Father, directly or indirectly, who is worshipped and adored.
Just a couple of things, you know. Godheads, in other words, there's three flavors of Godhood. Again, literally, a Creator son is Father-type deity, son-type deity, together as one. And so they're just reminding you, I mean, if that worship is directed to a Creator Son, that's indirectly to the Father, because there's Father-likeness, you know, an actual Father deity, within that Creator Son. So, it's a very mild indirect, you know, really. It's pretty direct in many ways. He who has seen me has seen the Father.
Yeah. Supplications of all kinds belong to the realm of the Eternal Son and the Son's spiritual organization. Prayers, all formal communications, everything except adoration and worship of the Universal Father, are matters that concern a local universe They do not ordinarily proceed out of the realm of the jurisdiction of a creator son. But worship is undoubtedly encircuited and dispatched to the person of the creator by the function of the Father's personality circuit. We further believe that such registry of the homage of an adjuster indwelt creature is facilitated by the Father's spirit presence. There exists a tremendous amount of evidence to substantiate such a belief, and I know that all orders of Father Fragments are empowered to register the bona fide adoration of their subjects acceptably in the presence of the Universal Father. The adjusters undoubtedly also utilize direct pre-personal channels of communication with God, and they are likewise able to utilize the spirit gravity circuits of the Eternal Son.
Yeah, especially when you think about the adjuster is a fragment out of that reservoir we call the Infinite Upholder. There's a direct linkage there into the Father that's separate from the Universal Father facet of God the Father. So that's a very easy way to understand what, the adjusters undoubtedly also utilize, direct pre-personal channels. Everyone is very familiar with this who has read the book for any length of time. This section, I'm sure you've read many times, this whole contrast between the Eternal Son and the Universal Father with prayer and worship. And you know what it's building to. You not only have Father-type deity and the Creator Son, we have Son-type deity. So prayer and worship are both have an immediate destination point in the Creator Son. They can both get to their ultimate destination through a Creator Son.
I've noticed that on Facebook, a lot of the Urantia book readers have a problem with praying to the Eternal Son. They can't seem to grab that.
That's why, don't do that. I mean, just back it off. That's what I was just saying. You can wrap your mind around directing prayer and worship to a Creator Son. Or at least the prayer part. I mean, forget about the Eternal Son part.
Some people can't even go there.
But, it is, again, they're going to tell us, this is not critical, that you somehow carefully sort this out. To begin to, appreciate that there's nothing magical here. This all has a literal modes of how this works, including him saying things like, there exists a tremendous amount of evidence to substantiate such a belief. This is the way the universe functions. The universe functions in literal terms here. They go out and they try to substantiate, a thought they have with direct evidence. And, we know how many times when they can't do that, they say, we don't know for sure because we've been trying to find some way to substantiate this, but we can't. We tried several different experiments and they were all null experiments. And they literally think like that about spirit substance, prayer and worship. They're not concepts. They're literal energy phenomena that can be measured and experimented with, investigated. This is all very literal, this stuff. And so it's in that literalness that you have this differentiation in terms of, the literal energy phenomenon that is prayer is connected to the Eternal Son's circuitry. The literal energy phenomenon that is worship is connected to the Father's circuitry. That it's in that sense that they're talking here, in the literal sense. And the reason they're giving us this is they want you to start. Like, wow, that is confusing. I can't figure out any way to match up my current notion of prayer with that thought. How are those two linked? That's the whole point. They want to create a really stark question mark. The only way to figure out how those two are linked is obviously to get prayer up to a higher level than we all have it right now. If we got prayer up to a higher level than any of us currently recognize, we go, oh, I see how that's linked. That seems very natural now. That's the point. It should be a complete conundrum. If it wasn't, You know, if the fact of the three existential persons on paradise is clear as can be to you, you know, why are you still sitting here? you know, why haven't you infused at least? Yeah, right. Yeah. Again, it's a humility thing. It's like, the real revelatory things should just catch you totally confused. It's like, wow, I don't get that at all. That must be a very revelatory point. Something that is going way beyond anything I've experienced yet. Something that I could really challenge myself to try to begin to have some notion of, to make sense of that. Okay.
Worship is for its own sake. Prayer embodies a self or creature interest element. That is the great difference between worship and prayer. There is absolutely no self-request or other element of personal interest in true worship. We simply worship God for what we comprehend Him to be. Worship asks nothing and expects nothing for the worshiper. We do not worship the Father because of anything we may derive from such veneration. We render such devotion and engage in such worship as a natural and spontaneous reaction to the recognition of the Father's matchless personality and because of His lovable nature and adorable attributes.
See, notice, actually, I want to give you a little clue to get you to start thinking about what we were just talking about so it isn't so abstract. Okay, reaction to the recognition of the Father's matchless personality. There's a thought there. That recognition, it's a thought connected to the thought God. You can imagine... wordless worship, but when you say prayer, your first thought is, okay, I can compose a sequence of words if I'm going to pray. Thought God, Word God, Eternal Son. Oh, maybe it's not as odd as I thought. Okay. See, so that's the beginning. Just reflect on, if they tell you something like, well, okay, what's the most foundational thing I know about the difference between the universal Father and the eternal Son? They call them the thought God and the word God. Oh, that does seem to have a little bit of a parallel to worship and prayer, doesn't it? That's the beginnings of a recognition. See?
You also mentioned earlier what they're saying between the lines.
Yep.
And it's almost saying, in order for you to have any kind of true worship, you've got to have that idea of the Father's personality. So they're saying, think first, get your God concept moved up.
Yeah, and along that line, very important that you noticed. It says the recognition of the Father's matchless personality. Not the Father's matchless self. He does have a matchless self also, but it doesn't say that. And remember what they were reminding you of, how this paragraph started. That prayer and worship section up in the, up in the Jesus papers. Prayer is self-reminding, sublime thinking. Worship is self-forgetting, super thinking. So if worship is self-forgetting, it's not just myself, it's also His self. It's a person-to-person linkage. It's that, they're that careful about the wording. That's the key. In order to truly worship, this can't be some self-notion, yourself engaging the aggrandized self that you call God. You've got to transcend self, yours and even His. You need to connect person to person. That's what it's about. The recognition of His matchless personality is in the worship mode. Okay? See? All right, so and Katie even brought this up earlier. The moment you were in prayer and worship, you thinking about this kind of this model that we always bring up, of the self is over here, the cosmos, God is over here, the temple here, the personal self is here. The animal origin self is over there. Okay. It's okay. Don't take it personally. Now you transcend the my left hand. It's okay. All right. So yeah, just that picture and how you can work with that analogy to think about what they're saying here. All right.
The moment the element of self-interest intrudes upon worship, that instant, devotion translates from worship to prayer, and more appropriately should be directed to the person of the Eternal Son or the Creator Son. But in practical religious experience, there exists no reason why prayer should not be addressed to God the Father as a part of true worship.
There it is. It's a practical. But if you want to start thinking about it a little more technically, okay, understand exactly how the universe is put together and begin to appreciate a little bit more the difference between the universal Father and the eternal Son, you need to not blur it all together, and you have to try to see if you can sort it out.
When you deal with the practical affairs of your daily life, you are in the hands of the spirit personalities having origin in the third source and center. You are cooperating with the agencies of the conjoint actor.
Oh, sure. Just make it even more complicated and bring in a third thing. Right? I knew I shouldn't.
This puts the personal, so-called mundane activities of our daily life in a much higher
plane. There's a flip side of it, too. Yep.
And so it is. You worship God, pray to and commune with the Son, and work out the details of your earthly sojourn in connection with the intelligences of the infinite spirit operating on your world and throughout your universe. The creator or sovereign sons who preside over the destinies of the local universes stand in the place of both the universal father and the eternal son of paradise. These universe sons receive, in the name of the father, the adoration of worship and give ear to the pleas of their petitioning subjects throughout their respective creations. To the children of a local universe, a Michael son is, to all practical intents and purposes, God. He is the local universe personification of the universal Father and the eternal Son. The infinite spirit maintains personal contact with the children of these realms through the universe spirits, the administrative and creative associates of the paradise creator sons.
Yeah, and everyone knows that. You've thought about that sort of fact many times. Maybe just inject one little thing that maybe you haven't thought about it in quite this way. Notice that one way you could relate to what they're saying there is, in terms of your more direct experiential life, maybe you ought to just challenge that experiential self to try to get a relationship with the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit. And at least for the time being, let the three existential persons be a little bit more of an intellectual exercise. They're there. You're beginning to understand how it fits together. But in a sense, they're kind of encouraging. It's a long reach. And it may even get you off on a little bit of a wrong track. You're going to be trying to fly before you can crawl. If you think you're really going to have some incredibly profound relationship with those three existential deities quite yet. So that's another way you can kind of interpret statements like that. They're sort of encouraging you, don't be in a rush to try to somehow have a profound relationship with those three existential deities. You've got these two beings that embody everything of those three, and the Trinity too. The Creator Mother Spirit has got the Trinity as well. All four of those existential facts have been brought down in very immediate, contactable form. Why don't you start with that? Work on that. And let the Father, the Son, and the Spirit and the Trinity be something that is a little bit more of what you're working on in your philosophic life. Trying to expand your, a philosophy of living that has a big context like that, as opposed to trying to, go too far down the road of an intimate prayer relationship with the eternal Son, So, that's one thought you could bring into the various places in the book that they, you know, remind you that to all practical intents and purposes, I mean, any possible notion that you can have of the Father right now is embodied within the Creator Son. You can't think beyond the margins of the Creator Son yet. None of us can. I mean, we are nowhere near profound enough in our capacity to see beyond the boundaries of the Creator Son. He's much bigger than our capacity right now. He's beyond our field. You know, his edges are beyond our field of view. So it's a good, solid place to start. You know, especially now post Pentecost, that Michael has the full embodiment of what comes down to you. So getting a hold of that is very grounded. You know, it's grounded in the, you know, in that seventh bestowal, right where you are. Getting a hold of that is there shouldn't be much danger at all. Trying to skip all of that and trying to jump way up, and you know, there might be some danger in play there, you know. So
sincere worship connotes the mobilization of all the powers of the human personality under the dominance of the evolving soul and subject to the divine directionalization of the associated thought adjuster. The mind of material limitations can never become highly conscious of the real significance of true worship. Man's realization of the reality of the worship experience is chiefly determined by the developmental status of his evolving immortal soul. The spiritual growth of the soul takes place wholly independently of the intellectual self-consciousness.
Okay, so that, notice how that's related to some of the things we were talking about in the previous section. There's, you know, they're trying to remind you of true worship, you know, actually is a pretty tall order. It's something in many ways requires a soul-like nature, and you don't have that until the next life. Okay. You know, the man's realization of the reality of the worship experience is chiefly determined by the developmental status of the evolving immortal soul. Okay. There may be a reality of a worship experience, you know, in the temple of your personal self. Okay. But the actual realization of that, see, it's realityized in the soul. You know, there's a reality, but it's realityized, you know, literally made substance in the soul, not in the temple, not in your, you know, your this personal self. You know, until that can be your brain, you know, and that can be the seat of your consciousness, there's going to be limits to true worship. And you know, the spiritual growth of the soul takes place wholly independently of the intellectual self-consciousness. Couple things there to reflect on. One, probably the first thing that ought to come to mind as you reflect on that is that man cannot cause growth. See? Now, that spiritual growth of the soul takes place wholly independently of your intellectual self-consciousness. Even the kind of consciousness that you have up in the temple where there's self-consciousness, you know, that consciousness is wholly independent of the soul growth. That's, you know, that's another way of thinking about why man cannot cause growth. I mean, you're in here, but the soul is not. The soul is separated from that. You know, so you can do all you want here. I mean, you know, I mean, God has to grow the soul. Only God has his hands on the soul right now. You don't. So there's that. And then the other thing is related to this whole developing your state of being, that meditation state, that's also woven into here. You know, you can have a well-developed intellectual self-consciousness, a well-developed recognition and experience with being in the temple, but see, that's wholly independent of soul growth. So, I mean, all the meditative state, all the presence in the world doesn't, you know, the soul growth is separate from that. And they're trying to remind you that, you know, that you're supplying a favorable condition, but it's up to God to grow. Only God, only a creator being can grow you. So, it's like, well, okay, so, well, when, if it's just the, you know, if just intellectual self-consciousness, a meditative state, basically, doesn't lead to soul growth, what does? One must do something as well as being, be something. You know, start doing something with the center in the temple, and then that will get reflected in the soul. God will copy that dynamic phenomenon into this cosmic-like expression, a fundamentally dynamic thing. See, it can't. That's what's getting copied, is that dynamic character. So,
can you describe what you mean by do something?
I mean, you know, you're going to do something that leads to the expression of the fruits of the Spirit. I mean, that's the easiest way to understand it. I mean, in terms of the inner life doing, we're talking about reflecting. We're talking about getting the cosmos and the self linked together. You know, getting the self, the animal origin self, to reflect the cosmos. So you have this inner doing where you get this linkage established, and cosmic harmony starts to be internalized to some degree. So that's the inner dynamic. But if that, you know, self has some cosmic character, then it will manifest the fruits of the Spirit. That's it will manifest the fruits of the Spirit, the cosmic fruits of the Spirit. But obviously it can't unless you've made it have a, you know, so that, I mean, Jim is right. I mean, the proof is in the externalization is the fruits.
And you're like praying for that person, yeah, because maybe they're having a bad day.
Well, no, just go. I mean, again, the specific, go read the list, you know, go up to the, you know, Jesus is the, read that. You know, the first one is loving service. You know, you can just stop there. You know, a beginning point of reflection. You know, we're not just loving. It's not just an inner life thing. It has come out, manifested, loving service. You know, you're doing something. You know, you're not just serving. That's first miler. You know, you have this cosmic reflection within, and it's expressing without. Now it's now taking on a second miler sort of phenomenon. It's not just, you know, those first miler sorts of things. Can anyone? I was just going to say them, but I was going to see if anyone. Compulsion is one. Duty. And convention, you know, just serving out of compulsion, duty, and convention, see, that's one thing. But loving service, see, that's free service and liberty-loving devotion. That second, taking, you know, beginning to take on some of that second miler nature. That's what doing looks like. So that's the point. Just reflect on the cosmic fruits of the Spirit.
So the fruits of the Spirit, is that someone's recognition of your devotion or...
Well, I mean, when they see you doing the actual thing that they mean by loving service, instead of just service, they will notice a totally transcendent quality to what's going on than anything they've seen before. It will have a genuineness to it, a selflessness to it, that goes beyond anything they ever imagined Mother Teresa doing or anything. I mean, it'll start to take on this incredible character that really only one person is what modeled well. We know who that person is. Jesus. The religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. That's the cosmic fruits of the Spirit.
The other thing about that list is that you start thinking, oh, I've got to do, you know, I've got to save the world or make sure everybody is fed or something. It doesn't have to be a humongous, I'm going to save the world kind of quality.
Right.
You can be driving on the right side of the road.
Yeah, and very much, you know, it's a long journey to the fullness of being a second miler. I mean, you know, to get to that first mile marker, so that beyond that is a second miler, to be, you know, in fact born again, born of the Spirit. I mean, to have not just one of those a little bit, but all of those things in the list. I mean, that's a huge, tall order, you know. But you can begin to try to do some of them sometimes, you know, and just start building up. And eventually you'll actually get to that threshold and you'll cross that first mile marker. And you will no longer be a first miler. You'll be a second miler. But it's a long ways down the road. I mean, it's a tall order.
Chris?
Yep. Oh, you got one back here, too.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's do this one back here.
Beethoven, of course, next to Mozart, probably was the greatest musician that ever lived. And he suffered from deafness. Mm-hmm. The older he got, the worse it got. But he could still hear the music in his head, and he could continue to write it. What he had done is he had written beyond their ability to appreciate and comprehend what he was doing. He says, I will write it if I only write it for me and God.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, most of the life that Jesus lived was completely over the heads of everyone. It was all over, you know, most of it went over the apostles' heads. And, you know, I mean, you know, it was for the whole local universe and for the ages, you know, that he lived that life. So,
yeah. The last things that he did in his life were the best.
And he was challenging himself to make a wholehearted expression. And notice how they kind of brought that up here at the beginning of this paragraph. Sincere worship connotes the mobilization of all the powers of the human personality under the dominance of the evolving soul and subject to the divine directionization of the associated thought adjuster. So you, that whole temple, you know, the mobilization of the powers of the human personality, that personal self, and it's benefiting from a synchronization with the soul, and from directionization, the adjuster within, and all three together. See, these three selves under the coordination of the personality, they're all together as one. That would be, you know, the fullness of sincere worship. And a state like that is going to be way over the heads of almost anyone. You're doing it for you and for God. After all, it is worship. It's just between you and the Father. Music is a great example. I mean, that was a form of worship, you know. Musical expression. Yeah.
Why did Jesus in the book say many times, because you're saying the soul is separate, mm-hmm. transfer your seat of identity?
Yeah, I mean, once you're a first circler, now you can transfer the seat of your identity. Your personality has an identification. Right now it's identified with the adjutant self. And once you're a first circler, you can begin to transfer that identification point to that Marantia self, that separate self. And even though, literally you can't start doing that until you're a first circler, you can begin to do it in truth, even though you can't yet do it in fact. I mean, just to think about what you're doing, even as a lowly seventh circler, is you're trying to set yourself down that path of, I'm doing what I'm doing now because I want it to be in line with what I will do when I become a first circler. What I'm doing right now is going to be is one step along that transference.
Do they also say that you can now give your soul authority to make decisions?
Right. I mean, your soul makes decisions all the time. I mean, it's minded. It's conscious. It's not personal, but it's conscious and making decisions. And that's related to what I was just saying. I mean, if you the more you can develop a significant personal self that can have some synchronization to the soul, you can let that soul make a soul-centered decision, and that decision can come into the consciousness of your personal self, and you can work off of it. You know, there's that whole section up in the adjuster papers that's talking about that. You know, but it's But it's important, if you're going to understand exactly what's going on, to remember that the soul is literally a separate self. It's separately minded. It's making separate decisions.
The soul mind is a dual mind, emerging mirage, a dual mind of the human and the divine working in synchronicity.
Right. I mean, you've got this whole complicated three-minded, thing that the personality is trying to bring together into a harmonious expression. And you're obviously not going to complete that task in this life, but luckily it gets a little bit easier in the next life. There's only two selves instead of three that you're trying to synchronize. All right, let's read the last one here.
The worship experience consists in the sublime attempt of the betrothed adjuster to communicate to the Divine Father the inexpressible longings and the unutterable aspirations of the human soul, the conjoint creation of the God-seeking mortal mind and the God-revealing immortal adjuster. Worship is, therefore, the act of the material mind's assenting to the attempt of its spiritualizing self under the guidance of the associated spirit to communicate with God as a faith son of the universal Father. The mortal mind consents to worship. The immortal soul craves and initiates worship. The divine adjuster presence conducts such worship in behalf of mortal mind and the evolving immortal soul. True worship in the last analysis becomes an experience realized on four cosmic levels: the intellectual, the morontial, the spiritual, and the personal. The consciousness of mind, soul, and spirit and their unification in personality.
And that, in many ways, there's a poetry to that, has all of this technical specificities carefully woven in it. It starts with, think about the animal origin self and the personal self and the two parts of the hourglass. So when they first bring up the contrast between those two, they say the act of the material mind's assenting to the attempt of its spiritualizing self. Okay, so that animal origin self giving it over to the personal self, that's assenting. And then when you're talking about that personal self, then they say that mortal mind consents to worship. Because see, when you're using consent instead of assent, it's with. You're with it, and it's very much bringing in will, personality. Okay, see, so that personal self, the animal origin self gave it over to that, and then the personal self took the ball, and willed the worship that the immortal soul craves. And initiates, and like they said in the beginning, I mean, really this true worship thing is something that only the consciousness of a soul actually can have, because it's a super additive consequence, like they said, of the relationship between your personal self and the adjuster self, giving rise to this morontia self, and only that super additive higher thing has the higher nature that can actually initiate what we're talking about here, this very transcendent true worship. And the adjuster conducts it. Okay, see? And then that final thing. See, so you literally have these four cosmic levels. You have, intellectual, remember that's a high mental word. So that's that personal self, the morontial. Okay, there's the morontia self, the spiritual, that's the adjuster, that's the divine self. All of it together. The personal, and their unification in personality. So, you can see how many parallels there is to what's going on in this, to that one spot up in the adjuster papers, where they try to get you to think about all these complicated details of three different selves and all of that. There aren't many places in the book where they challenge you to try to think about all that complexity. But here's one. Most of the time, they know that's just pretty hard to sort that all out. They just let it kind of be all balled together. But I'll recommend it again. A very valuable thing to do after these study groups, since we often, you know, here we spent a little bit over 2 hours picking apart all these details, and that can get a little bit tedious. But if you've forced yourself to kind of plod through all those details, now go back home by yourself and read it again. And because you spent the time like we did tonight, you know, when you just read it through, and it'll just take you a few minutes to read these two sections, you'll have a different experience with it, because you'll have that bigger context in which you'll be experiencing it in a more free-flowing fashion rather than dissecting every sentence like we do here. I mean, we can't do both here, you know. We can't both just read it and try to really embrace the fullness of it. This is a study group, you know, we pull it apart, and then you go home and you reread it, and you give it that more holistic experience. You know, and if we set up a process like that, you know, it'll become a little bit more of a positive reinforcement. That work you do at home, you know, will feed into what we're going to talk about next week. You know, and then back and forth it'll go, and it'll build a little bit more if you just make a point of trying to integrate what we do here on your own. You know, use your personality by yourself to integrate all of this complexity that we tend to, you know, unpack here every Friday night. Yeah, and your thought of Jess will be there to help with that. I mean, that's the way it should be. I mean, that should be your personal experience, that real integrated relationship to the revelation. Okay. All right. Well, let's take a moment here.